This is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us. Today on the program, we'll be reading a number of articles from a variety of sources, including an article from Space News about John McFall, a disabled astronaut that has been cleared for missions on the International Space Station. You'll hear a piece from the Arizona Republic about the state's shortfall in funding for the State Department of Developmental Disability. There'll be an article from Forbes about Getty Images' renewed focus on authentic disability representation. We'll open the program with this piece from Newsweek. It's entitled, "Woman Suddenly Realizes Her Guide Dog Took Advantage of Her Blindness," by Alice Gibbs, published February 17, updated February 20, 2025. The moment a guide dog took advantage of his owner's blindness has left people in stitches online. Ashley Herzig from New York shared a throwback video of loyal guide dog Yuri, who sadly died in December, remembering his cheeky streak. In the clip, Herzig said, "Thinking about the time my guide dog took advantage of my blindness and snuck this peanut butter jar on our walk," alongside a heartwarming video of Yuri gently carrying the almost empty peanut butter jar in his mouth. Herzig had Yuri as her guide dog for over 9 years before he retired to the suburbs with her mother. Since his passing at age 12, she has been reminiscing about his quirks, including his occasional talent for sneaky food heists. "The way he was breathing sounded off, so I felt for his nose to make sure he was okay, and that's when I discovered it," Herzig told Newsweek. "I just laughed. I took it from him for the duration of our walk, but once we got back inside, I gave it back to him to lick." Yuri had a history of unexpected finds, including once picking up a whole baguette in Central Park. Someone walking by was like, "Hey, do you know your dog has an entire baguette in its mouth?" "I did not know," Herzig said. Another time, Yuri grabbed a dog toy from the pet aisle at Rite Aid, forcing Herzig and a friend to purchase it for him. Now with her second guide dog, Mira, Herzig is adjusting to a new dynamic. Mira's motto is, "Work hard, play harder," whereas Yuri's was, "Work hard, then take a nap," she said. The video of Yuri's antics has delighted the internet, with over 3 million views on Instagram, and it has brought some joy to Herzig, who still misses her loyal friend. "My friends and family know how much I've been missing Yuri and will randomly text me pictures, videos, or memories of him," she said. "Someone mentioned the peanut butter jar incident, so I went searching for the video. It made me smile, and I thought the world could use a little serotonin boost right now." In the comments, people shared their reactions to Yuri's antics. "This is priceless," said one commenter. Another wrote, "That was his emotional support peanut butter jar." Herzig was delighted that so many people enjoyed the video, adding, "It warms my heart knowing that even though Yuri's gone, he continues to bring joy to millions of people who saw it." Now, from the Arizona Republic, "Pushing us off a cliff. Politicians squabble as funding for special needs kids runs dry," by Mary Jo Pitzel, published February 21st, 2025. Key points. Arizona's Division of Developmental Disabilities faces a $122 million budget shortfall. Parents and caregivers of those who rely on DDD services fear a lapse in funding will have dire consequences. Governor Katie Hobbs accuses Republicans of playing politics, while GOP lawmakers say Hobbs overspent without consulting them. An incredulous comment from a state lawmaker made public a brewing dispute over state spending. "I hope you're not suggesting that we cut the services to our children," Representative Stephanie Stahl Hamilton, Democrat Tucson, said in a budget meeting before she was cut off. "Yes, I am," said Republican David Livingston, the Peoria Republican who heads the House Appropriations Committee. "Literally to save funding?" Stahl Hamilton continued. "Yes, I am," Livingston repeated. This exchange came after a legislative presentation last month about a $122 million shortfall in the budget for the state's Division of Developmental Disabilities, often known as DDD. If lawmakers don't close the gap by late April, programs that serve some of the state's most vulnerable people will run out of money, putting continued services in jeopardy. Republican lawmakers said they were aghast at the shortfall and questioned why Democratic Governor Katie Hobbs overspent by $122 million without letting them know. Democrats were equally aghast at consequences for disabled children and adults in the program. A failed bid for more money. Flash forward nearly a month, and parents and caregivers crowded into a cramped hearing room at the state capitol Wednesday to show their support for stopgap funding for the program. It didn't work out well for them. The Appropriations Committee rejected an amendment from Representative Nancy Gutierrez, Democrat Tucson, to add $122 million to the agency's current year budget. Gutierrez said Arizonans who rely on developmental disability and long-term care programs face a life-changing situation if not fixed by the end of April. She asked Livingston to at least allow two people in the audience to address the lawmakers. The parents, some with their disabled children in tow, had been waiting all day for a chance to speak. Her request was denied. Republicans said they would fix the problem, but within the confines of the regular budget process. Typically, lawmakers and the governor don't wrap up negotiations on a budget until late May or June. Representative Julie Willoughby, Republican Chandler, said she's working on a bill to address the funding shortfall, although she didn't provide details. Packing a hearing room with demands for immediate action is not the way to win support, she said. As lawmakers explained their no votes, audience members trained their cell phone cameras on the action. Representative Matt Gress, Republican Phoenix, made note of the recordings and put the blame on Hobbs. You know it, I know it. Everyone at this Capitol knows that she has really created a mess, Gress said, his voice rising. Hobbs should be ashamed of herself and should apologize to the families, he said. Some of the audience walked out, while others murmured protests. Is it more important that Hobbs gets blamed or that our kids stay alive? Courtney Burnett, an Apache Junction mother of a child with a rare genetic disorder, asked after the hearing. Despite his complaint, Gress was the only Republican to vote with Democrats to support the immediate addition of $122 million to the agency's budget. The effort failed on an 8-10 vote. Hobbs on Friday issued a lengthy statement condemning the inaction as inhumane and fiscally irresponsible. By refusing to pass this bill, legislators are telling hardworking families caring for loved ones with autism, cerebral palsy, Down syndrome, and other intellectual or developmental disabilities that their needs don't matter, she said. Anxiety mixes with anger. After the push for additional funding failed, parents and caregivers held an impromptu town hall outside the House of Representatives with Gutierrez and several other Democrats. Some were sobbing. Others speculated about potential job loss and increased family stress. Many complained that despite the lawmakers' public expression of sympathy for their situation, their call to their state representatives have gone unanswered. You are pushing us off a cliff, said Michelle Thorne, co-founder and CEO of a program called Care for the Caregivers. Calls to emergency counseling services have increased, she said, citing what she's heard from fellow parents. The parents said they don't blame Hobbs. They had met with her staff earlier in the day and understood that Gutierrez's $122 million ask was done at the governor's request. Expecting families to go without services for 2 months until a new budget can be enacted is unrealistic, Burnett said. She was referring to the possibility of a two-month gap between late April, when the program's funds are expected to run out, and the June 30 deadline to have a new budget in place for the July 1 start of the next budget year. It's not just families that would be affected if a funding fix comes late, Burnett said. It would ripple through the system, affecting group home workers, therapists, nurses, and others. Burnett added she worries lawmakers would use their plight as a bargaining chip to win concessions in other parts of the budget. It's disgraceful, she said. Brandy Kuhn, who led the effort for the Parents as Paid Caregivers program, said she expects there will eventually be a fix to the funding issue, but it may come too late, she said. What drove up costs? At the heart of the dispute between lawmakers and Hobbs is the legislature's complaint that Hobbs went ahead with more spending for DDD programs without notification. A key component was the Parents as Paid Caregivers program. Launched during the COVID pandemic with federal dollars, it provided funding to parents who care for disabled children at home. Federal support was slated to be cut back as the current budget year started last July. Anticipating this, Hobbs in January 2024 proposed using state tax dollars to continue the program. However, lawmakers saw differently, and according to their budget office, no agreement was made. But in a report compiled last summer after the current year budget was approved, the Legislative Budget Office noted the governor intended to cover the cost of the parent program using American Rescue Plan dollars, as well as other pandemic-related funds. That kept the popular program in place. Coupled with a rate increase for the people who work in group homes for the developmentally disabled, growing enrollment in the DDD program, and some federal funding shifts, the state's obligation ballooned. The agency last month was looking at a $122 million shortfall that could cut off services by late April. Mid-year adjustments routine. Hobbs and her Democratic allies said boosting a program's budget in mid-year is not unusual. Representative Lorena Austin, Democrat Mesa, said GOP lawmakers in the previous budget year added $200 million to the state's private school voucher program. No one objected then, she said. Hobbs has made the same point repeatedly in recent weeks, accusing Republicans of weaponizing what is a routine budget process. She doubled down Friday, issuing a list of supplemental spending approved during each of the 8 years former Governor Doug Ducey was in office. It's happened under her watch, too. She noted that $274 million in extra money was sent to shore up the Empowerment Scholarship Account school voucher program 2 years ago due to ballooning enrollment. These same legislators remained silent on the runaway costs and lack of accountability within the Universal ESA Entitlement Program, which has had cost overruns totaling $385 million the last 2 years, Hobbs wrote. She called on lawmakers to stop their partisan games and act swiftly to approve additional DDD funding. The DDD program serves nearly 60,000 people, and the loss of funding could lead to institutionalization for many of them if support for caregiving by parents is cut off, Hobbs said in the statement. Belt tightening likely. There's no guarantee lawmakers will approve all of the money the DDD program is seeking. Livingston has repeatedly warned about the prospect of federal funding cuts, requiring the state to make up for the loss of funds. He's expecting anywhere from $1 billion to $3 billion, although it's too early to tell. This will be revisited, he said at the request to keep the DDD program running beyond late April, but he delivered a warning. Expect a leaner budget. We will reduce the costs, he said. Unlimited growth, no matter how helpful it is, we cannot afford it. He said if Hobbs wants immediate relief for the DDD program, she should work with lawmakers to swiftly produce a budget. In response, Hobbs's spokesman invited lawmakers to approve the budget she unveiled last month. They can pass the governor's budget now and raise pay for state troopers and state firefighters, lower the cost of child care and housing, and start tackling veterans' homelessness, all while protecting essential benefits for disabled Arizonans, spokesman Christian Slater said Friday. If they don't like that plan, they should show Arizonans their budget. Now from space news, ESA astronaut with physical disability medically cleared for ISS missions by Jeff Faust, published February 16, 2025, Washington. In a first, a European astronaut with a physical disability has been medically cleared for missions to the International Space Station. The European Space Agency announced February 14 that John McFall, a reserve member of the agency's astronaut corps, had been certified by a multinational medical board for long-duration missions to the ISS. The certification is noteworthy because McFall lost his right leg in a motorcycle accident at the age of 19 and wears a prosthesis. He's the first person with such a disability to be medically approved to train for missions to the station. John is today certified as an astronaut who can fly on a long-duration mission on the International Space Station, and I think this is an incredible step ahead in our ambition to broaden the access to society to space, Daniel Neuenschwander, ESA's Director of Human and Robotic Exploration, said at a briefing to announce the certification. ESA selected McFall as part of an astronaut class announced in 2022. That selection process included an effort by ESA to pick what it called at the time a para-astronaut to see if people with some physical disabilities could safely fly to space. Since his selection, McFall has participated in a feasibility study called FLY, that looked for any issues that might prevent him from going to the station, including both his health and overall safety of ISS operations. Let's not underestimate all elements linked to safety procedures when you operate on the International Space Station, said Neuenschwander. In all honesty, I was personally expecting some eventual showstoppers there, and I'm really happy to see that we went through that and it's behind us. I feel hugely proud, McFall said. The reception has been very warm and positive from the international partners there because of the detailed, methodical, exhaustive work we've done here with the feasibility study. That feasibility study examined more than 80 topics in areas such as training, ISS and spacecraft operations, medical issues, and crew support, said Jerome Reinix, FLY study manager at ESA. He expected a variety of technical difficulties, but those could be resolved. The main difficulty that we faced was not really technical, but about the mindsets, he said. People have preconceptions of what a person with a physical disability can achieve, and you have to go again, explain again, and demonstrate. While McFall is now medically cleared for an ISS mission, ESA has not yet assigned him to a flight. Now he is an astronaut like everybody else who wants to fly to the space station, waiting for a mission assignment, said Neuenschwander. Today, we cannot give any date. McFall is one of 12 reserve astronauts selected in that 2022 class who are part-time members of ESA's Astronaut Corps and eligible for specific flight opportunities. One of those reserve astronauts, Marcus Wandt, flew to the ISS on Axiom Space's AX3 private astronaut mission last year through an agreement between the Swedish Space Agency and Axiom. A second, Slawoj Uznanski-Wisniewski of Poland, is slated to go to the ISS in the spring on the AX4 private astronaut mission. Neuenschwander suggested long-duration ISS missions would be flown by ESA's full-time career astronauts, five of whom were selected in 2022. Our objective is to fly all of them on a long-duration mission before the end of the International Space Station, he said. The ISS is currently slated for retirement around 2030. McFaul has previously been linked to a potential private astronaut mission under study by the UK Space Agency under a Memorandum of Understanding with Axiom signed in October 2023. That study is examining an all-UK spaceflight that could be commanded by former ESA astronaut Tim Peake, who joined Axiom as a strategic advisor in July 2024. McFaul said at the briefing that discussions between Axiom and the UK Space Agency are continuing. It's a very interesting prospect, he said, saying that the agency has been very proactive in trying to be as prepared as possible should this translate into something. It is fantastic to see that John and the team at ESA have proved it is technically possible for someone with a physical disability like his to live and work on the International Space Station, said Liz Johns, interim head of space exploration at the UK Space Agency, in a statement, adding that the agency would support him in the next phase of that effort. Neuenschwander said that such a private astronaut mission would be a decision for the UK Space Agency. Whatever the mission architecture and financing scheme is, today we have the clearance to fly, John, and this is the most important point. This next piece comes from The Telegraph. It's entitled, "I Thought My Disability Would Stop Me From Skiing, Until Now." With the rise of adaptive snow sport initiatives in ski resorts across the globe, our writer takes to the slopes in Breckenridge. By Savannah Finestone, published February 16, 2025. With spectacles on a chain, vintage knitwear, and an antique obsession, my Grandma Sav's aesthetic was always a running joke. Then I broke my hip, and things got all too real. As a type 1 diabetic, I've felt old before my time. Cataract surgery as a teenager, swollen legs, and now, with a hip replacement, skiing was a dream I'd parked. Until now. The invite came from Breckenridge, a charming ski town in the Rocky Mountains. Experience our disability skiing program. That word, disability, I hate it. And I hate even more that I fall into that category. But the fact is, my health complications mean I'm less able to do things others take for granted. The slopes of Colorado were calling, and with the Invictus Games around the corner, celebrating the transformative power of adaptive snow sports, my hurdles felt comparatively small. Watching winter athletes push boundaries on this scale gave me the final nudge to experience firsthand how adaptive skiing can redefine what's possible. Arriving in Denver on the coldest day of the year was a baptism of ice. At a toe-curling minus 30 degrees Fahrenheit, minus 34 Celsius, even the most rugged mountain dwellers were chilled to the bone. What had I gotten myself into? As someone who wears jumpers midsummer with circulation that's always struggling to get going, I'd already kissed my extremities goodbye. A 2-hour drive from Denver through screensaver landscapes that left me as breathless as the altitude lay the charming town of Breckenridge. I was warned about altitude sickness, and having moved no further than from sofa to fridge in the past 3 months, the endurance factor would be an uphill struggle. I arrived at Gravity House, the cool kid lodge on the Breckenridge block. Perched at the top of Main Street, it's conveniently close to the best eateries, bars, and shops. Plus, it's just across the plaza from Breckenridge Outdoor Education Center, BOEC, where my adaptive ski lessons would be. With equipment rentals, the Maggie restaurant, and even the Quicksilver chairlift all within a snowball's throw, it was a total ski-in, ski-out dream, and importantly, ideal for someone with limited mobility. On arrival at BOEC, I was welcomed by Jeff Inouye, the program's chief for over 30 years, along with my specialist instructor, Sam and Marcy, one of 300 dedicated volunteers. The warmth of Jeff and his team melted any worries. After a thorough 2-hour session testing out which adaptive equipment would work best, a process tailored to each student, we decided on the seated bi-ski. Adaptive skiing is about precision and teamwork. There's always a 2-to-1 instructor-to-student ratio, ensuring a level of support that goes beyond anything at regular ski school. Sam secured me firmly into the bucket of the bi-ski. She meticulously adjusted my outriggers, the arm-controlled skis. Then I learned how to control them. As I followed her commands, practicing my lefts and rights, regaining my balance by looking forward, it was incredible to feel the whole rig tilt with just the slightest movement of my head. Communication is also key, between instructors and between students and instructors. The responsibility put on students is something I didn't expect. "If you want a ride, go to Disney," Jeff called out to me. His no-nonsense, straight-talking was refreshing. With this scathing quip, my chauffeur-driven dreams of being pushed down the hill like Lady Penelope were dashed. No instructor would be physically holding on to me, just guiding with tethered straps. The bi-ski isn't a glorified sled, it's a high-octane sport. When we ventured onto the slopes, people stared, but not how I was used to. With my dad using a stick and later a wheelchair due to his MS, I'd grown accustomed to side eyes and gawking. But this time it wasn't pity, it was awe. It's one thing to be a competent skier with 2 functioning legs, but carving down the slopes in a sit-ski? That's next level. The thrill of doing something I shouldn't be doing, it was that wow moment for them and the feeling of redefining possibility for me. Then came the moment I dreaded, the chairlift. I'd catastrophized all sorts of disasters, flopping out at the top, causing a pileup of unsuspecting skiers, being mowed over. The reality was far simpler, yet equally terrifying. I was so snugly packed into the bi-ski that shoehorning me out wasn't a possibility. As the chairlift slowed for boarding, Sam and Marcy tilted me forward and perched me on the lift, perpendicular, poised like a rocket about to launch, then lowered me onto the seat, wedged securely. Admittedly, it's not the most relaxing of positions, suspended in midair, tilted forward over the edge of a chairlift with no control. But with an instructor on either side, I felt safe. There was constant reassurance from Sam and Marcy, and at every moment I knew I was in capable hands. As a duo, there's a spotter on the pistes and an extra pair of hands to help lift equipment. It's no wonder, then, that I felt surprisingly secure as we prepared to descend off a precipice ominously named the Whale. Sam gave me her signature reassuring smile. "You've got this," she said as she checked the tethers. The sharp Colorado air stung my cheeks and a pang of fear hit my stomach, but Sam was unflappable. As we pushed off together, the ground falling away beneath us, she was right. I shouted back to Sam, but she was way up the hill behind me. The sudden realization that she wasn't holding on to me was frightening and then thrilling. I was skiing on my own, carving the snow like I belonged there. I couldn't believe it. I was flying down the slope, guided by Sam on the tethers. For many students, this independence is transformative. BOEC isn't just about enabling people to ski. It's therapy disguised with adrenaline. Jeff told me about a boy who was nonverbal when he first arrived. Years of traditional therapy hadn't made much progress, but through skiing, his confidence soared, and so did his communication skills. Skiing gave him a voice. And Jeff makes sure that finances aren't a barrier to these transformative experiences. Each year, BOEC provides over 80,000 pounds in scholarships, ensuring that anyone who wants to hit the slopes can do so. After our session, the atmosphere was electric. Back at headquarters, students shared stories and parents beamed with pride. For parents, familiarity breeds comfort, and at BOEC, returning year after year builds a crucial foundation of trust. I watched as a mother tucked her son with Down syndrome into a sit ski, kissed his forehead, and they set off together, his excited yelp echoing. I blinked back tears. BOEC isn't just a program. It's a life changer. The instructors create opportunities, provide access, and empower people with disabilities to experience the great outdoors. Here, skiing isn't just an activity. It's a pathway to independence and a reminder that adventure should be for everyone. Essentials. Adaptive ski lessons with the Breckenridge Outdoor Education Center cost from $255, 205 pounds, for a full day, one-to-one instruction, lift pass, and equipment. For more information about adaptive ski and snowboard lessons, scholarship applications, internship programs, and volunteering roles with the Breckenridge Outdoor Education Center, visit boec.org. Gravity House Breckenridge offers accessible rooms from $173, 139 pounds, per person per night. United Airlines flies from London Heathrow to Denver for 468 pounds return. Return transfers with Epic Mountain Express cost from $228, 183 pounds, per person. And now a reminder, this is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Well, next up is this piece from Forbes entitled, Getty Images Renews Focus on More Authentic Disability Representation, by Gus Alexiou, published February 7, 2025. Getty Images, which recently announced its merger with Shutterstock, cements its position as the world's leading image library. Earlier this week, it committed to focus on ensuring that its images depict disability authentically and with appropriate diversity. Getty Images is a go-to resource for creatives seeking images to support their storytelling, from brand leads to journalists and art directors. The organization works with more than 575,000 content creators and covers more than 160,000 news, sports, and entertainment events. However, when it comes to disability, image resources often tend to be dogged by several major flaws. These principally revolve around portrayals of disability that are wooden and one-dimensional. All too often, images of disability are shown through a medical or caregiving lens, as many as 3 in 4 images, according to the company's research, whilst also over-relying on the use of recurring props, such as wheelchairs, to convey the idea of disability due to their instant familiarity. The net effect, significantly amplified in this context by powerful ripples across the media, is, of course, the perpetuation of harmful stereotypes. Though undoubtedly a complex problem with no one easy answer, as part of the pushback, Getty Images announced earlier this week that it is teaming up with U.S. telecommunications giant Verizon and the National Disability Leadership Alliance to offer financial support to assist photographers in reimagining the disability community. Instead of care settings, the lens is to shift to the workplace and professional life to convey the idea that life with a disability can be rich, diverse, and full of innovation and achievement. The financial mechanism to foster this enhanced creativity comes in the form of $20,000 in grant funding, which will be split between 3 successful applicants, with one receiving $10,000, a second receiving $7,000, and a third $3,000. The grant, known as Disability in Focus, also involves mentorship and royalty perks for successful applicants and will be awarded to shortlisted photographers and videographers by an expert judging panel. Applications close on March 7, with applications from photojournalists with a lived experience of disability particularly welcome. Chronically underrepresented. Since 2004, Getty Images Creative Grants has awarded over $2.6 million in the pursuit of photographic craftsmanship. In an interview undertaken over email, Dr. Rebecca Swift, the company's Senior Vice President of Creative, explains why this year's award is so important. Visualizing workplace diversity is essential to fostering an inclusive culture. Yet the disability community remains one of the most underrepresented groups in visual content across media and advertising, Swift says. Our ultimate goal is to empower brands and marketers with the content necessary to break away from stereotypical imagery, such as a person in a wheelchair, oftentimes portrayed alone in an image or surrounded by able-bodied people. In reality, the disability community is much more diverse and varied, including a range of disabilities and lived experiences. She continues, unlike a wheelchair or a prosthetic limb, disabilities like autism, chronic pain, or hearing impairments may not be immediately apparent or easy to portray in visuals, which means creators must take a more nuanced approach to storytelling. By broadening the visual language of disability, we can ensure that workplace imagery reflects a full spectrum of experiences, fostering a more inclusive and representative world. In a media release accompanying the announcement of the grant, Zachary Bastian, Verizon's manager of strategic alliances, said, "As a brand driven to power how you live, work, and play, Verizon is thrilled to continue our ongoing collaboration with Getty Images and the National Disability Leadership Alliance through this timely and exciting creative grant." Also adding, "Navigating work life represents a great opportunity to dive deep into people with disabilities thriving in careers. Fortunately, this program is not the first to recognize the paucity of dynamic disability imagery that is easily available to brands and content creators." In 2018, Getty Images, Verizon, and the National Disability Leadership Alliance launched the Disability Collection, which includes over 12,000 curated images and videos devoted to portraying disabled people more authentically and accurately. Last year, UK-based Business Disability Forum launched its own collection of 480 free images for its members, aimed at depicting disability more broadly to incorporate conditions such as neurodiversity, mental health, facial differences, and energy limitations. Nevertheless, the invisibility of such conditions across the media is so ingrained that it will undoubtedly require multiple pushes over several years to significantly move the needle. But if the saying is true that a picture paints a thousand words, then ensuring that the best people get their chance to create the right pictures should get us there a little bit faster. Next up is a piece from the University of South Florida newsroom entitled "Seeing Beyond Sight: A USF Blind Student's Journey into Broadcasting," published February 17, 2025, by Paul Guzzo. First there were tears, then there was hope. Now there's inspiration. Trent Ferguson's family wept when, as a baby, they learned he was blind. Ferguson was diagnosed with irreversible total blindness due to optic nerve hypoplasia. Late one night, a few months later, grandfather Dean Ferguson hoped the radio would soothe his howling grandson. When Roy Orbison's Pretty Woman came on, the baby looked in the direction of the radio. Cries turned to coos. "I knew then he was perfect," the grandfather said. "I just knew he would be fine and was meant for great things. I couldn't have known that radio would play a big role in that." Ferguson is now a senior at USF, majoring in mass communications with a concentration in broadcast program and production. My dream job is to be a host or co-host of a major sports talk show on a radio network, he said. Ferguson has already been working toward that goal for a decade. He got his start recording public service announcements and a podcast, and then became an on-air talent for area radio stations, including serving as a color commentator for high school football games. Ferguson initially took a break from working in radio so he could focus on his studies at USF and made his on-air return in December. From his residence hall, Ferguson produces weekly sports news segments that are broadcast at 6:30 and 7:30 a.m. on Sebring's WWOJ 99.1. "I'm blind, but I don't let it stop me," said Ferguson, who writes scripts in Braille and edits with software designed for the visually impaired. "I don't see it as a hindrance. I see it more as a way of life." None of his jobs have been pity hires. He's not employed because he's blind. Rather, he is a radio personality who happens to be blind. "He has a ton of talent," said Michael Ewing, general manager of Highlands Radio Group, which owns WWOJ 99.1. "He studies his craft, he has worked on his voice, he earns everything." Radio beginnings. In a way, Ferguson's on-air career began with the sound of air brakes in his hometown of Avon Park. When at his grandparents' house, that noise let him know that his grandfather had returned from work driving a bucket truck for the Florida Power Corp. The air brakes would pop and, starting when he was maybe four, he'd follow the sound right to the truck, Ferguson's grandfather, Dean, said. "He'd climb in and sit in there for hours listening to my work's CB radio and talking to my dispatcher." Inside the house, his fascination with radio continued. "He could hear a commercial jingle and then immediately mimic it on the piano," Dean said. He then provided his grandson with a subscription to satellite radio, on which he continued to listen to Roy Orbison and similar musicians from that era. At around five or six, wanting to hear his voice on the air, he began regularly calling into his favorite morning radio show, hosted by Gordon Flash Phelps on the 60s On 6 channel. "Listeners absolutely loved him," Phelps said. "They thought a little kid who loved the 60s and had that great personality was the cutest thing." Phelps turned Ferguson into a regular part of the show. Sometimes he peppered Ferguson with music or elementary school trivia questions. Other times he elicited an innocent chuckle through a cheesy joke. "Did I ever tell you about the time I bowled a 301? Phelps asked in one bit that he still has saved. "That's not possible," Ferguson replied. "You ever hear about anybody who bowled a 300 and lost?" Phelps answered. During those bits, not once did either Phelps or Ferguson mention blindness. No one knew, Phelps said. It didn't matter. It mattered at school. Teachers worried whether they were prepared to properly educate a blind student, and classmates picked on him. "Stupid things like asking how many fingers they were holding up," Ferguson said. "It never bothered me." After third grade, Ferguson's family decided it was best for him to transfer to St. Augustine's Florida School for the Deaf and the Blind, where he lived in a residence hall 4 hours from home. "I cried almost every day at first," he said. "I also knew it was for the best." It led to his pursuit of a career in sports journalism, becoming a radio personality. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers' booming cannons taught Ferguson just how powerful the radio can be. On Fridays, the Florida School for the Deaf and the Blind chartered buses to take students home and then again on Sundays to bring them back to campus. During the long rides, Ferguson listened to sports radio, especially loving the Buccaneers' games announced by Gene Deckerhoff. "Fire the cannons," Ferguson screamed with his best imitation of the Tampa Bay sports radio legend's celebratory catchphrase. Ferguson hoped to play for the school football team as a kicker, but the physical education teacher said that would be too difficult. "I was really bummed," Ferguson said, "so I thought, Well, if I can't play a sport, I'll cover a sport. As Ferguson's obsession with sports grew, his other grandfather, T.J. Kenyon, fed it by taking him to occasional weekend games at which he listened to the radio broadcast while soaking in sounds and feel of the live crowd. If I could get tickets, he wanted to go, Kenyon said. He loved it. Ferguson said he still gets goosebumps thinking about when his grandfather took him to a Buccaneers game for the first time to hear the cannons live. That day helped him to appreciate Dekkerhoff's talent. Being there felt almost exactly like how he made it feel when I listened on the bus, he said. Through the radio, he put me in the stadium before I was ever actually in the stadium. I wanted to be able to do that for others. Knowing of his dream to be on the radio, in 2012, a teacher arranged a pregame meeting between Ferguson and Enrique Henry Alou, the Rays' Spanish radio color commentator, who also is blind. He was a hero who became a mentor and now a dear friend, Ferguson said. We still talk regularly. The best advice he ever gave me was that I have to work hard for anything I want to achieve and go after it because no one is going to do the work for me. That advice led to Ferguson's big break. In 2016, while on a school field trip to Flagler Broadcasting's radio headquarters in St. Augustine, he made sure to stand out during a class discussion with General Manager David Ayers. He knew everything about us, Ayers said. I mean, everything, from our formats to the height of our antenna. I was completely blown away. Ferguson's self-deprecating humor also stood out. To this day, he laughingly replies with comments such as, I will see you there. So Ayers had an idea for the go-getter. He made Ferguson the voice of public service announcements, advocating against texting while driving, as in, it's so dangerous, it even scares the blind. Ayers next connected Ferguson with Flagler Broadcasting Radio personality Rich Carroll. The two launched the tongue-in-cheek podcast, Out of Sight Sports, later becoming a regular part of Flagler Broadcasting's WNZF's Saturday morning lineup. That led to Ferguson being promoted to weekday morning sports anchor. I was clear that if he could not edit, I could not keep him, Ayers said. I wasn't just giving him a job. He had to earn it. He promised it would not be an issue, and it wasn't. There's nothing he cannot do. That included working as Flagler Broadcasting's radio color commentator for high school football games. He couldn't analyze the play, so he brought other things to the broadcast. I prepared by talking to the coaches, studying old stories and statistics, and reading through the athletes' social media pages, Ferguson said. I wanted to learn personal stories and add those tidbits to the game. After earning an associate degree from South Florida State College, he considered several schools for his bachelor's degree, but chose USF partly so he could be in the same radio market as his favorite sports teams. The scene is terrific with the Bucks, the Lightning, the Rays, the Rowdies, and the Sun, he said. I hope to land in the Tampa Bay radio market someday. But Ferguson was also drawn to USF because he trusted the professors would work with his blindness while not giving him a free pass. I didn't want anything handed to me, he said. On to USF. Senior instructor Wayne Garcia's media and society class had 300 students in a large lecture hall, yet Ferguson stood out on the first day. Heads turned as he walked in with a cane, Garcia said. As the semester progressed, Ferguson continued to stand out, but on his terms. He was always the first to start a dialogue when I'd ask the class a question, Garcia said. He never shied away from the spotlight. During one class, they were planning a field trip and debating the best way to meet up. Ferguson offered to drive everyone. That's Trent. He was obviously joking. Maybe, Garcia said with a laugh. He's so confident that he can do anything. He doesn't believe in obstacles. He probably taught me more than I've taught him. I've always said that anything is possible with hard work, but Trent proves that. Ferguson's degree requires video production classes. In lieu of creating visual projects for electronic field production, instructor Ryan Watson allowed Ferguson to produce audio ones. He produced a car chase story in the style of old radio serials. And for a documentary, he created one about how to navigate the campus while blind. It used only oral and written narration, interviews, and sound effects while the screen remained black to symbolize blindness. "He doesn't make excuses," Watson said. "He didn't tell me that he couldn't do the projects and ask for a way out. Instead, he found a way to participate and be the best version of himself. You can't help but to love his work ethic." But there is no workaround for the TV direction and production class. Ferguson had to direct a scene, so he got creative. He produced a Name That Tune game show, researched camera angles, and learned which ones similar programs typically use for specific scenes and moments, and conveyed those to the crew in real time. "I was calling the shots," Ferguson said. He always has, and that, and not his blindness, is his definitive quality, Grandfather Ferguson says. He adjusts to everything, he always finds a way to do things. That's what makes him perfect. You don't have to be perfect. Our next article comes from the Disability Scoop. It's entitled, "Lawsuit Filed by 17 States Threatens Disability Protections, Advocates Say," by Michelle Diament, published February 20th. Over a dozen states are seeking to invalidate one of the nation's key disability rights laws, advocates are warning, jeopardizing access to health care, education, and more. A lawsuit brought by Texas and 16 other states is calling for an end to Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. The 1973 law bars discrimination on the basis of disability at any entity that receives federal funds. The suit, known as Texas versus Becerra, was filed in response to an update to Section 504 regulations that was finalized by the Biden administration last year. With the litigation, the states are looking to ensure that gender dysphoria does not qualify as a disability under the rule. However, in challenging the regulations, the state's lawsuit asks the court to declare Section 504, Title 29, USC, Section 794, unconstitutional in its entirety. If this happens, it would be a disaster for disabled people, and everything from education to employment would be negatively impacted, said Maria Towne, president and CEO of the American Association of People with Disabilities. Section 504 has a broad reach extending to healthcare, public education, housing, transportation, and much more, advocates say. While many students with disabilities are covered by the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, federal figures show that 3% of students are served under Section 504 alone. The latest 504 regulations clarified that medical providers cannot make treatment decisions based on disability biases, expanded the availability of accessible medical diagnostic equipment, and set expectations for accessibility on providers' websites and mobile applications, among other changes. If the court were to determine that Section 504 is unconstitutional, disability advocates are concerned that the basis of such a decision could also undermine other laws, including the Americans with Disabilities Act. If the judge were to adopt it and actually declare the statute unconstitutional, it could portend that other anti-discrimination statutes based on race and sex and ethnicity are also unconstitutional for the same reason, Stephen Schwartz, senior counsel at the Center for Public Representation, said during a recent webinar. And because there's provisions in the regulations that tie together, that link 504 in the ADA and prohibitions on race and sex discrimination, it links them all in how they're enforced. Striking down the rule might imperil the ADA as well. Schwartz described that scenario as simply frightening. Now, disability advocates across the nation are calling for states to back out of the litigation, and facing significant pressure, the attorneys general are attempting to distance themselves from the suit's request to overturn Section 504. Plaintiffs clarify that they have never moved and do not plan to move the court to declare or enjoin Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, Title 29, U.S.C. Section 794, as unconstitutional on its face, reads a joint status report the states filed with the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Texas on Wednesday. The attorneys general indicated in the filing that they are continuing to evaluate their position in light of a recent executive order President Donald Trump issued on gender ideology. But a statement from South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson's office said that the filing is a big step towards this lawsuit winding down and going away entirely. However, the latest filing is not easing concerns from advocates. Despite representations from several attorneys general that the lawsuit would be dropped, they'd withdraw from the lawsuit, or they'd withdraw the constitutional challenge to Section 504, none of that occurred. They did not file an amended complaint, so the claims and scope of the case remains unchanged, said Allison Barkoff, a professor at George Washington University, who led the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration on Community Living under the Biden administration. Rather, Barkoff said that the filing actually doubles down on the state's constitutional claim. As an example, they claim the rule's requirement to provide services in the most integrated setting, consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Olmstead versus LC, is unconstitutional, Barkoff said. If a court were to agree with them, not only would it undermine 25 years of progress through Olmstead enforcement, but it would also mean that Section 504 would not apply to entities that receive federal health care, education, housing, or transportation funding. In addition to Texas and South Carolina, the other states involved in the lawsuit are Alaska, Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Kansas, Louisiana, Missouri, Montana, Nebraska, South Dakota, Utah, and West Virginia. The case is currently paused with another update expected in a month. And that's the final article for today's program because we are out of time. Thanks for joining us and listening in for the Disability News Program. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Keep listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona.